This has been a big year, plenty to talk about in 2018. We've gathered a smart group of people to help us kick back, unwind, and think about what the heck happened this year. It is time for The Break Room.
And as the bell rings here in the stadium, bells ring all the way around Korea.
Meghan Markle, no longer known as Meghan Markle. Her title now is Her Royal Highness Princess Harry.
This is not a speech of concession.
It's time to leave the divisive politics of the past behind us and focus on Georgia's bright and promising future.
Wakanda forever!
2018 right there. And joining us in the break room are Georgia State University professor Hector Fernandez. Amanda Hollowell is on the line, and she's a community organizer in Savannah. Greg Williams, host of Greg's List Live, and writer and editor Anjali Njeti. Welcome, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning, Virginia.
Good morning, Virginia. Good morning.
Really glad you're here. Well, let's start with the arguably biggest story of the year, the 2018 midterm elections. And Georgia got a lot of national attention and buckets of outside money for this. Former Secretary of State Brian Kemp elected governor in a close race against Democrat Stacey Abrams. Let's go back to May, when Kemp got a lot of attention for this ad. This was just before the primary.
I own guns that no one's taken away. My chainsaw's ready to rip up some regulations. I got a big truck, just in case I need to round up criminal illegals and take them home myself. Yep, I just said that. I'm Brian Kemp. If you want a politically incorrect conservative, that's me.
So Kemp ran in the primary as a politically incorrect conservative, but as we heard just a moment ago, his tone has actually shifted a little bit to unity. And after such a divisive election, plenty of people in entrenched camps, will he be able to be a governor for all Georgians? I'm going to give that to you first, Greg.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, unfortunately, the way the primary system is in this country, you have such low turnout. So it tends to skew heavy left or heavy right, because that's the voting block that turns out for these. But, you know, governors are CEOs of the state. They aren't hyper-partisan necessarily like a U.S. Congress or U.S. Senator. And they have to do the business for the people. And I strongly sense that Brian Kemp is going to govern from center right. It's certainly going to be a more conservative platform, maybe than even Governor Deal. But I don't think RFRA is coming back. I don't think a lot of the fears that the business community has are going to actually come to fruition under Governor Kemp. And I'm looking forward to the next 4 years.
And you said RFRA, that's the Religious Freedom Act.
Yep.
That was proposed, at least on the trail. But what do you think there? Some red meat for the base? Who wants to pick that up? Hector?
I think people are not going to forget as easily as he wants them to.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're going to be constantly reminded that he engaged in what could be construed as unethical behavior. You know, the whole thing remaining at his post while he was running for office. So he might want to shift his position, but I don't know whether people are going to read it the same way.
Well, new Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger says he's going to restore faith in the system. What do you think it's going to take, Anjali?
Well, he's also said he's going to pursue the same methods that Kemp did as Secretary of State. And look, the issue to me comes down to the rampant amount of voter suppression we had. And I think a lot of Georgians are not going to see him as the rightful governor of Georgia. And we can't know how many people were prevented from voting on Election Day. We can't know whether there were 60,000 more people who were purged from the voter rolls, didn't know it, weren't able to correct their voter registrations before they actually showed up to vote on Election Day. So these are things that we just don't know. And unfortunately, because we use very outdated hackable voting computers to tally votes to begin with, we don't really have evidence of what this election could have been. And I think that's a problem for a lot of Georgians.
Well, many lawsuits and many accusations of voter suppression, certainly. And those are going to be investigated as the months roll on. But Amanda, what are you seeing down there in Savannah, generally thought of as one of the blue dots in a red state?
I mean, you know, we definitely delivered a Democratic ticket all the way down here in Savannah with the way we vote. But I
the thing that troubles me, it's not even about the voting machines, it's about voter suppression. It's about the lack of access and education, how they handled voting on that day when you had 4 and 5 hour lines. I remember delivering food and umbrellas to folks who were waiting to vote. And if that process doesn't change, if we don't change from when you apply for an absentee ballot to when you actually go and vote and what that system looks like and actually invest in those folks who are operating these voting locations, we're not going to move the needle forward in Georgia for voting access to all.
Well, speaking of moving the needle, Governor-elect Kemp beat Abrams in the statewide race, of course. But Democrat Lucy McBath unseated Republican Karen Handel in Georgia's 6th congressional district. A suburban mom who really ran on a single issue, gun violence. Her son Jordan was a high school student when he was shot to death. Here's one of her ads.
We thought maybe he would be a community activist. What I thought I saw in him is what I've become. When I go to Washington to champion for people, to fight for them, it's not just my policy agenda. It's something I've lived.
McBath beat Handel for a seat previously held by Tom Price, Johnny Isaacson, and Newt Gingrich. So, question to you all, is Georgia still a red state? Is it turning blue, or is this an isolated case?
It's already purple. It's going blue. By the next election, it'll be blue, hopefully.
What are the rest of you seeing, Greg?
Well, I mean, I think it's trending purple, but it really depends who the Democrats have at the top of their ticket. You know, they have somebody charismatic like a Stacey Abrams that's going to drive African-American turnout. That's going to boost their numbers. That's what happened all across the northern suburbs is they got about a 10 to 15 point increase in African-American turnout. And I did just want to say this. We had almost presidential election turnout in Georgia. We had 95% turnout of a normal presidential election. So I really push back against these claims of voter suppression. Long lines on Election Day, that means a lot of people went out to vote. I don't think that's a problem. And we had early voting for 3 weeks, the absentee ballots. Nothing's going to be perfect. We have 159 counties in Georgia, second most in the country behind Texas. Every county is going to have things done a little bit differently. There are going to be some major improvements with Raffensperger coming in. They're going to update the voting machines. And, you know, we're going to see Georgia be in a battleground state, certainly with Trump, if he is on the ballot, which, you know, at this point, I'm not 100% guaranteed that Trump will be on the ballot in 2020. We're going to have the same dynamic as Republicans to face that we did in 2018, where suburban white women are leaving the Republican Party and becoming independents and voting against Trump and not against what I consider their best interest as far as fiscal soundness in the state of Georgia.
Now, we did see record voter registration this year. 6.9 million, 3.9 million voters actually participated in November. But then less than half that turned out for runoffs for two very important seats. So much momentum lost in just a month. What does that bode for 2020?
So, I mean, for me, I think the issue with the turnout for the runoff was simply a timed issue, right? Mm-hmm. We had a lot of people who were interested in voting who could not vote for the general election. Mm-hmm. We had an issue of trying to notify voters for the election. So, and it is a ground game, I think, elections. I think there's nothing that replaces going door to door and knocking on people's doors and asking them, telling them about the election and having them come out to vote. So I think for 2020, what this means is we need to expand our ground game. I mean, look, when I was canvassing for the runoff election, I would knock on people's doors who would tell me on a Saturday that they were going to go vote. Well, we didn't even have weekend voting for the runoff election. And so people with traditional jobs, people with multiple jobs, didn't even have the chance to vote in those 5 days we had for early voting and weren't able to vote on Election Day either. So I think what would help tremendously is making voting more accessible. And that's what we have to do. I mean, long lines for voting is actually a sign of voter suppression. It's a sign of not having enough election machines.
Georgia's population has increased significantly.
Absolutely.
In the past 7 years. It seems the Secretary of State's office isn't well enough equipped, certainly.
Right. We're not progressing as quickly as we should to accommodate these voters.
Amanda, I hear you chiming in. What do you got?
Well, no, I totally agree. And, you know, I'm glad she pushed back that voter suppression is happening here. I think the idea that exact match came into play and then folks at actual districts didn't even know that they weren't supposed to be participating in that and denying people the right to vote. So I think it's wrong to think that this is just something that we're making up or miss or trying to stir the pot with. This is an issue here in Georgia. Another big problem is that amendments are released like, what, 2 weeks before we go and vote? Folks are not able to read the legalese and make it a plain English statement on deciding on how to vote. And so if we're not even making it easy for people to understand who pay tax dollars for this service, right, to understand what is at stake and, you know, these constitutional amendments that were actually proposed to be added or ratified. I mean, these things are issues, and we are not respecting people's rights to vote because we're not providing them the access, the tools, and just understanding where they're coming from so everyone has that that ability to vote.
All right, we're going to leave that as we got to move on in this break room. Swerving a little ways off politics, Georgia's hands-free driving law went into effect about 6 months ago. Just first here, fess up. Anyone get a ticket?
Oh, not yet.
So we see a real change in behavior here in Georgia?
Not at all. A lot of people are still using their phones. A lot of people are still holding their phones in their hands. I don't know how, but they're going to need to figure out a way to enforce the law. I mean, I just see too many people doing things that are way dangerous with their phones while driving.
I thought it was going to impact me a lot more, but I ended up just buying a brand new car that had the hands-free technology. So I'm keeping the economy going with Chevrolets. But I, as a real estate professional, this law really bothered me because I did think it was unenforceable. I thought it would have an undue impact on minority communities specifically. And it hasn't.
All Everybody right, uses the phone, not just minorities.
We're going to wrap that, leave that right here and pick that up when we get back. This is The Break Room. We're wrapping up 2018. Hands free. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is the shortest day of what feels like a really long year. It was the year that Georgia rolled out the red carpet for Amazon and Wakanda became a destination. We're wrapping up 2018 with a year-end break room. Here with me are Amanda Hollowell. She's a community organizer in Savannah. Georgia State University professor Hector Fernandez. Greg Williams. He's host of Greg's List Live and writer and editor Anjali Njeti. So internal documents at Facebook. Facebook's been sharing a lot more user data than they had previously admitted, even while assuring users of their privacy. Has anyone deleted their Facebook account?
So I used to be a huge Facebook user, possibly addicted to it. And a few weeks ago, I've just decided to not use it very often. I'm still pretty heavily reliant on Facebook Messenger, though. And let's be real, Facebook owns also WhatsApp and Instagram. Yeah. So I'm not even sure if me limiting my use in Facebook is going to do anything for anybody. But I've been disturbed by the news about Facebook for the past year or so. But the personal message sharing is kind of what got me. The fact that, you know, messaging individuals is being shared. That really is what sort of put the nail in the coffin for me with Facebook.
Yeah, they're just everybody tracking all your movements. Google with their cookies, every website you go to a lot of times to even get access to it. They say, we have cookies if you accept or not, blah, blah, blah. So we're under an illusion that we still have privacy. Mm-hmm. It's very, yes. very hard to live off the grid. My mom says, oh, I don't have a Facebook. I said, well, you're on Facebook, Mom, whether you like it or not. So to me, I'd rather have an active page so I can somewhat control what's going on in my social media identity rather than live in ignorant bliss, so to speak.
So the boycott hasn't pulled a lot. What do you do? Hector, you want to add something?
No. Basically, control is an illusion. They're all constantly collecting information on you. I mean, I use Waze to get here. Waze picks up information on
Absolutely.
You.
Mm-hmm.
Each time you Google something, they know exactly what you're looking for. They're building a profile. So it's an illusion. And, you know, what I'm trying to do is minimize across the board.
Well, the activism that the boycott inspired hasn't gone too far. But let's get to another big story about activism and also a Georgia story. Conservative legislators passed a bill to remove a $50 million tax exemption for jet fuel after Delta severed ties with the NRA. Part of the fallout from the killing of 17 students and staff at Marjorie Stoneham Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. The surviving students, a group of super media savvy teenagers, grabbed the country's attention and said, you know, we don't want your thoughts and prayers. We want action. Wondering for you, Amanda, you've done a lot of community organizing work in Savannah. Have young people changed the game in activism in the U.S.?
No, I think, you know, if you look back at the civil rights movement, all those folks were in their 20s and 30s who are doing those movements. I think, if anything, one benefit of social media is that it's highlighted, and young people now have a unfiltered voice to really get out there and share their message. I do most of my organizing through Facebook Messenger, so yeah, that's...
Same.
So, you know, and I mean, I might move to Snapchat because it disappears after a while. But
you think it does.
Right. We think it does. You can't bring it back up. But I think at the end of the day, it's either you're going to play the game or you're not. Mm-hmm. What young people have done is they've shown us how to create, craft, and deliver a powerful voice and a message and a medium through using technology. And I think that's amazing. And I think what they're saying is important. I think what they're saying should really shape how we feel about ourselves and what we're trying to do. And what we really should do is actually look to them as our future leaders, and not future as in a couple of years or decades, like someone told me before. But like, today you get to lead this group. Well, today we want to hear your voice.
I was a little stunned to think that Parkland happened in this year. I mean, it feels like a really long time
ago.
Sure
does.
And this was viewed the top story of the year by the AP survey, along with The Economy, by The Wall Street Journal and NBC. But it feels like those conversations stopped. You know, then came the Capitol Gazette shooting, then the Thousand Oaks shooting. How are you keeping up with all of these mass shootings?
I think one of the biggest challenges is not going numb. Is seeing this as an urgent, imperative issue and working towards getting legislation passed so it doesn't happen again. But this can be hard to do when it happens over and over and over again. And I'm not sure how we fight that, how we fight sort of the apathy. I mean, when something comes routine, it becomes really tough to overcome it and to keep going.
But I also think we have to stop sensationalizing death. Right?
Absolutely.
So what we're doing right now is like, mass shooting happens. Let's exploit the person who committed it. Mm-hmm. Let's find the stories. National headline. Oh, and then someone's done something more ridiculous and more shocking. I think what we need, we really need to send the message of like, life is valued. And when there's not a mass shooting, there's still someone dying from a gun from guns in this country.
Well, it's so
right?
unlikely that any real massive gun legislation will actually happen. So after the Parkland shooting, President Trump did form a school safety commission released their recommendations this week. Do you think people are feeling safer sending their kids to school, Greg?
I think so. And I mean, half of gun deaths are from suicides. I think that's what we really need to address. My wife got me watching this 13 Reasons Why show, which, mm-hmm. you know, I'm sure we could talk about that for another segment. But I think that is really glamorizing suicide. That was my personal take on it. And I think that, you know, with these programs being so formative for teenagers, that they look like, or they look at them as they can be a celebrity if they follow this blueprint. And I think that's one of the biggest dangers. We're all, unfortunately, a country with 310 million people that has three guns per U.S. citizen, I think, is the number. We're never going to eliminate guns, nor should we want to eliminate guns. We should make it harder for mentally unstable people to get them. And we should also look at ways that we can beef up school security, because these school shootings have become rampant.
We have a problem in terms of regulation, the culture. The Canadians have as many guns and weapons as we have, and they don't kill themselves at the rate that we do. I mean, the recommendations from the President's Committee, they're nonsensical and they're out of touch. I don't think most of the families across the nation sending their kids to schools feel any safer at all.
Well,
I mean, they're beginning to spend money on it, but...
Mm-hmm. I'm going to move on to another issue, because this was, again, the continuation of Me Too this year. Bill Cosby went to jail for sexual assault. Les Moonves out at CBS may not get his $120 million package. Celebrity chef Mario Batali. McDonald's workers walked out off the job demonstrating and fighting harassment in their restaurants. So the continued momentum of this movement calling attention to sexual harassment and assault. But of course, the big issue this year was the nation glued to Christine Blasey Ford's accusations of now Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh of sexually assaulting her when they were teenagers. People walked away with that from with distinctly different impressions. So was 2018 a win for Me Too, or was the response to Dr. Ford a sign of a backlash?
I think it's a sign that we need to continue to evolve to give survivors the space to tell their stories and to give survivors the resources that they need to survive sexual assault and to center them in the story. I mean, I think it's very easy to have these sort of sensationalistic headlines in the news. But at the end of the day, survivors need resources. Rape kits need to be tested. We need to provide, you know, the basic support to people who undergo this and who live with it for decades without any opportunity to heal.
Overall,
this is the issue that may have turned the tide for many voters.
Overall, I think it was a win for victims' rights, and that's the way I kind of look at this, right? We had Marcy's Law pass pretty heavily here in Georgia with an 80% plus margin that allows victims of crimes to be notified if their assailant or alleged assailant is released. The Me Too movement, a lot of males that had victimized women have been put in jail or their careers have been necessarily destroyed. The Kavanaugh, that took away a lot of the momentum, though, because three out of the four witnesses have been completely discredited and admitted to lying. And so that, you know, unfortunately, all of the progress that was made, a lot of men and a lot of, you know, women were looking at that and saying, well, see, we told you. We said that this was a lot of false accusations, and sure enough, it is. So I think, you know, when you have such a high-profile case that has proven liars, that certainly
I'm going to pick up on that because I don't remember the news of them admitting to lying.
Right.
I'm remembering this differently. Does anyone have the...
I'll send you the links after the show.
I also remember it differently as well.
Too.
Yeah, so
okay. Yeah, that's selective memory.
Right.
Well, you guys are reading different blogs, I guess.
That's for sure.
You guys are reading the fake news.
This is really interesting point, though. You know that where people get their information has a lot to do with what kind of decisions we make, what kind of things we walk away with. So let's talk about something that united Georgians. Atlanta United. Mm. 2018, the year an Atlanta team finally brought home a championship, and Atlanta United did it right here at home. So let's go back to that very first game and goal in Mercedes-Benz Stadium.
Take it quickly in for Carmona. Back for Almiron. In swinger from him. Flicked along to the backside. It's in! It's Leandro Gonzalez Perez! First goal in this stadium. First goal of the day for Atlanta.
All right, Hector throws his hands up in the air. I guess you're feeling that one. Atlanta United won the MLS Cup in its second year in the league, breaking home game attendance records. In other sports, not so great for the Braves and not so great for the Falcons or the Hawks. But will MLS soccer ever be as big as the NFL or NBA or Major League Baseball?
It's well on its way. I mean, look, mark my words, it may take 100 years, but football is a dying practice, you know, whether people want to acknowledge it or not. The school leagues are already dropping in enrollment. Football is already going the way of the working class. Soccer is going the way of the middle and upper class, according to research. So it may take a while, but it's going to happen. Besides, soccer is a global sport. Basketball is modeling itself. It's actually modeling itself after soccer. And as for baseball is the national pastime. Baseball is not going anywhere. But as for American football, shoots. I don't know. I have my doubts about that. To me, it just sounds like a very barbaric and Roman sport. But the MLS is going ways. And the fact that it has happened in Atlanta, the capital of the South, of all places, should be an indication of things to come.
Well, Atlanta, you know, we've got the eighth biggest population in the country now by state. So we have an influx of people from all over the country. And we've always had a very strong soccer culture here. I played growing up. I played for my high school, had a couple scholarships to some small schools in Florida. And back then it was still called commie ball. So we still had that hurdle to overcome.
Oh,
but yeah, well, you know, we've come so far.
You're showing your colors.
So Atlanta United is a great story. My favorite part of that story was, you know, that they took the cup, the physical trophy, on a little field trip on Monday night after the parade.
Yes, they sure did.
That shows how far that we've come, right?
You know, it's interesting in soccer because if you take any typical American family, usually at least one of those kids has played a season or two of soccer in preschool, elementary school, middle school. And then suddenly soccer disappears when kids graduate from high school.
Well, no longer so, right?
But you would think that soccer would be, professional soccer would be bigger here than it is.
Actually, the MLS, just today, a story came out saying it's the most sustainable league in the world.
It's actually turning profits right now. And I do think it'll eclipse baseball. MLB is under a lot of stress right now for the games being too long and too boring. So
I think you'll always have some pushback from a true football fan. Like, I am a football football fan. I have a son who's probably going to get a full ride scholarship to a, God willing, a D1 school. I think when soccer moves into early education, when they start offering like full rides and you're having these signing days and these events, right, around you being a star soccer player, then your trajectory and you're tracking these people into a professional league. And I think that's where soccer lacks in America. Like with baseball, with football, with basketball, which is our pastimes, you can actually track your athlete from high school to a professional career if they're very an outstanding
person.
Oh,
it's already happening. Georgia State is giving scholarships for soccer.
Right, but I just don't think, like I think your eclipse again, I don't know if it's 100 years, I don't know if it's 10 years, I don't know if just 1 year, like everything just blows up because people are tired of the Kaepernick story and they're like, I'm over it.
All right, I'm gonna veer off just to involve some of the people in our Facebook group. In my bubble, I see more white middle-aged men who think hands-free has a special exemption for them, writes Catherine. Let's see. We've also got in Hancock County, it is young black women. I suspect that demographic explains which groups will be the male offenders. I'm not sure I fully understand that one, but we're going to move on to one big pop culture story for the year. Maybe the biggest global pop culture story. Meghan Markle married Prince Harry in May. In October, the couple announced they're expecting their first baby due this spring, which generated some buzz on TMZ, of course.
How pregnant is she?
She is between 12 and 15 weeks.
Do you show in 3 months?
Yeah.
Are they backtiming this a little bit?
No.
Mm-mm-mm.
Now, I'm not going all Kardashian on this. I'm saying that this rises to the level of a break room conversation because of the social issues that were raised by this. Meghan Markle been targeted with mean, sometimes racist comments on social media. One person tweeted she's holding on to the bump like someone's about to snatch it. So two questions here.
Whoa.
Should people even care if she was pregnant when they got married, you know, doing that back count? Or is Meghan being held to a different standard than other women because of her race?
You know, I think obviously women of color are tremendous targets in social media. It's an onslaught, really. I mean, I think women in general feel it, but I think especially women of color. And, I really feel for Meghan Markle, and I hope she's, you know, being protected the way she should be, because, I think the chances that something serious could happen to her are higher, especially since she's such a public face and has been married into a very prestigious family. But it's a real shame because this should be a very joyous experience for her. She should be able to concentrate on building her family, and to have to see that. I mean, it's just terrible.
So is the resentment just because she's a woman of color, or the fact that she's American? I think, you know, if you know anything about the Brits.
That was Wallace Simpson. That was quite a while ago. That was quite a while ago. That was years ago.
Well. You know, I'm so sorry that we have to wrap on that, of all things. My goodness. But I want to thank you all for being here with me. Hector Fernandez, Amanda Hollowell, she's a community organizer in Savannah. Greg Williams, host of Greg's List, and writer Anjali and Jetty. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, and happy
holidays.
Happy holidays.
This does feel like a pretty monumental year for you, me, as personally picking up my life and moving to Georgia about halfway through. And I am above all grateful for the support of the entire team here at GPB. I may be the voice that you hear, the face on the billboards and the buses here in Atlanta, but the real engine is a pretty amazing group of producers. Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, and the Raven Taylor. Our engineers, Tyler Morris and Alec Kaslow, and our tireless senior producer, Amy Kiley. So grateful to Don Smith, Bram Sable-Smith, and to Sarah Shariari, and an extra special thanks to Sean Powers. Our theme song written by Alex Crispin and Marshall Ruffin. And I want to thank you for all the encouraging words and messages, for giving me a chance. I'm well aware that you have many choices for where to turn your attention and life and in this crowded media space. I think that listening to another person is the greatest gift. It's not something I take for granted, and I thank you. I'm Virginia Prescott. Happy holidays, however you celebrate. This is On Second Thought.